From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And so people are bracing themselves to basically be left without water or electricity for an indefinite amount of time. They're buying up canned goods, cooking gas, and heating oil. They're buying bottled water, which is more expensive than gasoline in this country.
Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, an exclusive from Baghdad and Basra. He obtains top-secret UN documents, which reveal how the UN is planning to operate in a post-Saddam Iraq. Then, a report back on the humanitarian and legal implications of war.
The Center for Economic and Social Rights found that there will be an extreme humanitarian crisis should there be a war.
There's concern that the basic principles guiding humanitarian action will not be respected.
Also, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark calls for the impeachment of George Bush and a report from the UN as Colin Powell is about to address the UN Security Council. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State General Colin Powell addresses the United Nations Security Council today. He'll try to make the case for a first strike attack on Iraq. Each of the other 14 council members will have up to 8 minutes to respond. Those responses will likely determine whether the UN Security Council will vote for a new resolution authorizing military force. Powell's speech will be televised around the world and is regarded as the most important speech by an American diplomat in recent history. More on this in a few minutes. NASA's now saying the chunk of insulating foam that broke free from Shuttle Columbia's external fuel tank was the biggest piece of debris ever to hit a shuttle during launch. But the Los Angeles Times reports some NASA investigators believe the damage that caused Saturday's accident may have been caused by a meteorite or man-made debris while the shuttle was in orbit. At a memorial service at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, President Bush said the U.S. would push forward in its conquest of space. Bush said, quote, "This cause of exploration and discovery is not an option we choose. It is a desire written in the human heart." The Bush administration is coming under increasing scrutiny over its proposed $2.2 trillion budget that greatly expands the military budget while cutting domestic programs. The Financial Times describes Bush's economic analysis as a work of fiction. The New York Times reports over 1 in 5 children who receive free school lunches could be dropped from the program. San Jose Mercury News reports the Bush administration is seeking a 9% increase for nuclear weapons funding. Bush wants to restore facilities to produce nuclear warheads that were shut down after the Cold War. He also wants to pursue a controversial program to develop new battlefield nuclear weapons to destroy underground bunkers. The Christian Science Monitor notes the budget contains no cost of war in Iraq, nor does it include a request to pay for the ongoing war in Afghanistan. Agence France-Presse reports the U.S. government is preparing to launch an Arabic-language television station in the Middle East as part of a public relations campaign aimed at boosting the U.S. image in the region and reducing the influence of Al Jazeera, considered the CNN of the Arab world. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage said yesterday face-to-face meetings between Washington and Pyongyang will take place to discuss the dispute over North Korea's nuclear program, but no timeline has been set. A whistleblower from inside the gun industry has claimed that dealers knowingly sell firearms to criminals and juveniles. And Robert Ricker, the former executive director of the American Shooting Sports Council, added that, quote, right-wing wackos from the National Rifle Association are dictating the gun control debate. Ricker made the allegations in an affidavit on behalf of 12 cities and counties in California that have brought civil actions against weapons manufacturers and dealers. Five members of a California jury have apologized to a man they convicted last week of growing marijuana and have demanded a new trial. The jurors are upset that they never knew that the defendant, Ed Rosenthal, was growing marijuana for medicinal purposes, which is allowed under state law. A federal judge barred mention of the state law. Rosenthal faces at least 5 years in prison. The UN Security Council has given French and African troops in Ivory Coast a mandate to use force in order to protect civilians. Meanwhile, thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of Ivory Coast's main city, Abidjan, in the second week of angry demonstrations against a French brokered deal to end the West African nation's war. U.S. corporate trade policy risks isolating Muslim allied nations who back the Bush administration's so-called war on terror. The Progressive Policy Institute found many Muslim nations are becoming more isolated from the global economy, causing economic shortfalls. And a Swiss court will allow a group of 600,000 gypsies to proceed with its $12 billion lawsuit against the computer giant IBM. The gypsy organizations are arguing the company helped the Nazis with the Holocaust.
There's dust collecting on the floor, and it's here we go, another war. But I don't sweat it, I won't be getting in line.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to our listeners and viewers around the country. I guess President Bush managed to, even before the body parts of the tragic accident with Columbia had been all collected, the president had to rush through to have a memorial service so he could get to today's events at the United Nations and his war preparations.
Speaking of body parts, also in New York, there is a major demonstration that is planned for February 15th, expected to be larger than anyone yet, in conjunction with protests around the world. And basically, the police have denied a permit for them to move, calling it, saying they could only have a stationary event. I wonder if that means people are just supposed to write to their Congress members, right, take out the stationary?
Of course, all this will do is drive up legal costs, because obviously it'll go to federal court and it'll be overturned.
Well, today, Secretary of State General Colin Powell is addressing the UN Security Council. He'll try to make the case for a first strike attack on Iraq. Each of the other 14 council members will have up to 8 minutes to respond. Those responses likely will determine whether the UN Security Council will vote for a new resolution authorizing military force.
Administration officials have worked late into the night over the past week, sifting through photographs and other classified material that could bolster Powell's presentation. White House officials say Powell's multimedia presentation will include recently intercepted communications within Iraq showing that Saddam Hussein is trying to hide weapons of mass destruction from UN inspectors. The New York Times is reporting Powell may also present satellite images showing Iraqi soldiers moving equipment and burying objects just ahead of UN inspectors' arrival on particular sites. The Washington Post reports Powell will include declassified satellite images of suspected mobile bioweapons labs. An administration official said Powell may choose to reveal those photographs only in private meetings with Security Council members, claiming that this is due to concerns about revealing too much about surveillance technology. But Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix yesterday dismissed all of this. He said inspectors expected to be bugged by, quote, several nations and took great care not to say anything Iraqis could overhear. He said there is no evidence of mobile biological weapons laboratories or of Iraq trying to foil inspectors by moving equipment before his teams arrived. And he said he had received tips from the U.S. that led him to inspect two alleged mobile labs. He found nothing.
In addition, General Colin Powell will try to make the case that Iraq has links to al-Qaeda. Debates have raged in the administration as recently as yesterday over how much to emphasize this argument. But an official British intelligence report leaked to the BBC today says there are no current links between the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda. The top secret document was written by intelligence staff 3 weeks ago. It says there has been contact between the two in the past, but the fledgling alliance foundered due to ideological differences between the militant Islamic group and the secular nationalist regime of Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraq's deputy prime minister, Tariq Aziz, told Le Figaro newspaper that Iraq does not want war with America and is ready to explain everything to UN inspectors. The interview hit newsstands just hours before Powell's speech. Aziz added, quote, "The American Secretary of State will not be able to show that Iraq has arms of mass destruction." The interview comes on the heels of an exclusive interview that is done by veteran British former parliamentarian of the Labour Party, Tony Benn. He conducted this interview with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein himself. It's the first interview Saddam Hussein has given to a Westerner in recent history. It begins with Tony Benn asking the question, and listen carefully. He asks about weapons of mass destruction, and then Saddam Hussein responds with an interpreter.
Mr. President, may I ask you some questions? The first question is, does Iraq possess weapons of mass destruction?
Most Iraqi officials have been in power for over 34 years and have experience of dealing with the outside world. Every fair-minded person knows that when Iraqi officials say something, they are trustworthy. A few minutes ago, when you asked me if I wanted to look at the questions beforehand, I told you I didn't feel the need, so that we don't waste time. And I gave you the freedom to ask me any question directly, so that my reply would be direct. This is an opportunity to reach the British people and the forces of peace in the world. There is only one truth, and therefore, I tell you, as I have said on many occasions before, that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever. We challenge anyone who claims that we have to bring forward any evidence and present it to public opinion.
I have another question which has been raised. Do you have links with al-Qaeda?
If we had a relationship with al-Qaeda and we believed in that relationship, we wouldn't be ashamed to admit it. Therefore, I would like to tell you directly, and also through you, to anyone who is interested to know that we have no relationship with al-Qaeda.
In relation to the inspectors, there appear to be difficulties with the inspectors. And I wondered whether there was anything you could tell me about those difficulties and whether you believe they will be cleared up when Dr. Blix and Mr. Bareda come back to Baghdad.
You are aware that every major event must encounter some difficulty on the subject of the inspectors and the resolutions that deal with Iraq. You must have been following it, and you must have a view and a vision as to whether these resolutions have any basis in international law. Nevertheless, the Security Council produced them, These resolutions, implemented or not, or the motivation behind these resolutions could lead the current situation to the path of peace or war.
Saddam Hussein responding to the questions of British MP, veteran Labour parliamentarian, formerly, Tony Benn, speaking to Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. This was aired on Sunday night on the British Channel 4. Special thanks to WBAI's Robert Knight.
And in other developments, French President Jacques Chirac refused to bow to British and U.S. pressure, declaring in a meeting with Prime Minister Tony Blair that war is, quote, the worst possible solution, and calling for U.N. inspectors, weapons inspectors to be allowed to continue their work. Blair has been feverishly trying to persuade Security Council members to back a U.S. attack. The Financial Times reports an article today that if the U.N. Security Council does not issue a resolution authorizing force, Blair's own Labour Party could be torn apart by dissent. Also, an undisclosed number of F-117 stealth fighters have left their base in New Mexico for expected deployment in the Gulf. The Norfolk-based aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt and its battle group finished training in the Caribbean and is heading overseas.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says 600,000 people could try to flee Iraq if the U.S. attacks. The agency is drawing up contingency plans. Kuwait announced that areas bordering Iraq would be closed off as a special military zone from February 15th. In other developments, an undisclosed number of F-117 fighter stealth fighters have left their base in New Mexico. We are going to now go to an exclusive report from Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Baghdad.
Here in Baghdad and in cities and villages across Iraq, people are bracing themselves for what they believe is going to be a massive U.S.-led attack. There is an awareness here that the U.S. has threatened to hit Baghdad with 300 to 400 cruise missiles in the first 24 hours of bombing, followed by 300 to 400 in the second 24 hours. The talk of 3,000 missiles raining down in Baghdad in the early stages of a bombing, more than was used in the entire Gulf War against Iraq. You see people across the city and across the country digging wells in their backyards or in their gardens for water. In some cases, people have to wait up to 3 days just to get an estimate on how much it will cost to dig the wells because of the demand. They then have to send the samples to laboratories to be tested to see if, in fact, the water is potable. And the reason that they're doing this is because the U.S. in the past has targeted Iraq's water treatment facilities, its electrical facilities, its sewage facilities. And so people are bracing themselves to basically be left without water or electricity for an indefinite amount of time. They are buying up canned goods, cooking gas, and heating oil. They're buying bottled water, which is more expensive than gasoline in this country, where $2 will get you 25 gallons of gas. Some wealthier families are buying power generators, small power generators, but for most Iraqis, that's just simply out of the range of their economic condition. Now, some Iraqis here in Baghdad are saying that in the coming days they're going to be leaving the city, heading for family farms or homes in more rural areas. Other people are saying that they're going to stay put, they're going to remain in Baghdad, some of them fearing that their homes would be looted or destroyed if there was internal strife caused by the U.S. attack. Many Iraqis also say that they are not going to be going to bomb shelters when the U.S. bombing does begin. They remember very well February of 1991 when the United States bombed the Al-Amaraya shelter, ripping a hole open in that shelter and then dropping another bomb into the hole, incinerating more than 400 Iraqis, many of them women and children, who had gathered for the Muslim celebration of Eid. Now, on the surface, daily life is continuing as normal here in Baghdad. You see people in the cafes, the streets remain congested with cars, the markets are crowded, but under it all there is a sense of panic and fear that is moving across this country. And as millions of Iraqis prepare themselves, brace themselves for what they know is going to be a massive attack by the United States, the United Nations itself is already looking to the administration of a post-Saddam Iraq and a post-Saddam government inside of Iraq. Democracy Now! Has obtained confidential United Nations documents that deal with the possible post-war governance of a role in Iraq for the United Nations. And one of the most striking things about this is that the United Nations is essentially admitting that the United States and any occupying force would be governing the country and that the United Nations would play a subservient role. The report says, quote, in the short term, the external force waging the war will be in command and may administer the country or impose a certain authority. After 4 to 8 months, the document continues, the UN may be given more room for limited responsibility in terms of governments and the establishment of security and justice. So clearly, the United Nations willing to take that subservient role to the United States and any other occupying force. It also says that it's unlikely the UN is going to play a role like it has in East Timor, where it essentially governed the country. Instead, the report says that the UN role is likely to be determined according to the request of either the new authority or the foreign forces that will provoke a change of regime through war. Also, the UN documents that we've obtained indicate that the United Nations is aware that any government that takes power after Saddam Hussein is likely to also be an authoritarian regime, and that it will certainly take such actions as executing agents of the United States or Israel inside of the country. The United Nations in these documents says that it is basing all of its assumptions or presumptions on what it calls a medium impact scenario. And the United Nations defines that as the military campaign encounters significant resistance but ends after a more protracted period of 2 to 3 months. As a result of a large-scale ground offensive supported by aerial bombardments, there would be considerable destruction of critical infrastructure and sizable internal and external population movements, the report says. Access to war-affected civilians would be severely limited for the duration of the conflict. The report says there is a, quote, major risk of civil unrest in areas around Iraq that is likely to result in high levels of casualties. Interestingly, the United Nations also is saying that at the first indication of hostilities, as they put it, perhaps more appropriately, at the beginning of a U.S. attack, the U.N. would evacuate its entire international staff from Iraq, leaving only Iraqi nationals in those offices, as well as dependents and non-essential staff, the international staff, from Jordan, Kuwait, Israel, Yemen, and Lebanon. So essentially, the U.N. would be abandoning this region directly around Iraq of all of its international staff. Now, what we have also learned from sources that are close to internal U.N. discussions is that many of the U.N. workers have already begun quietly leaving the country in anticipation of massive attacks by Washington, but the U.N. is not saying this, nor are they declaring an official evacuation. These people are simply going on vacation on paper, and our source said that the U.N. does not want to create the impression that an attack is imminent, and it's not official policy yet, but we have learned that they've already begun to withdraw from the country. Also, the Iraqi government yesterday staged a very big parade involving the Fedayeen Saddam, the Saddam militias. Some call them the suicide bombers of tomorrow. They were dressed in the Hezbollah-type garb, as well as the Al-Quds Army, the Jerusalem Army, which is a wing of the Ba'ath Party, as well as some factions of the ordinary Iraqi army, perhaps as many as 40,000 marching through the northern part of Iraq in Mosul. But the situation here in Baghdad now is that the United Nations is already looking toward governing, toward the governance of a post-Saddam Iraq. They are going to be withdrawing their personnel, as they already have begun doing so, and they are predicting that there are going to be there's going to be a large-scale humanitarian crisis here, up to 800,000 Iraqis attempting to cross borders into neighboring countries, 500,000 asylum seekers stranded at borders, according to internal documents of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So what we are seeing right now inside of the country is that people are heading into panic mode. They are stocking up. The government is amping up its propaganda on television. It's holding military parades for journalists. But again, ordinary people fear, and it's a right fear, it appears, that they are again going to be made to pay a very, very heavy price for this war that the United States has waged against Iraq now for well over a decade. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
That report by Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, exclusive report, that latter part based on the document put out by the UN ECPS, Emergency Contingency Preparedness Strategy, obtained by Democracy Now! You are listening to Democracy Now! We come back, report back from Iraq with the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Stay with us.
You loved your sweet country for all of your life, like your mother and father before you. And the land runs deep, so deep in your blood, your flesh and your bone and your sinews. Descendants and ancestors deep as it goes, Her relative circle as far as your eye. It can all be undone in the flash of an instant. Mechanical thunder that bruises the sky, bruises the sky. Goodbye to my relatives all of my life. Never again will I see. You won't have a name when they fly the big airplanes. Collateral damage is all you will be, all you will be.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Jim Page, Collateral Damage, that music. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Colin Powell is about to address the United Nations Security Council. We're getting a report back from Iraq. A high-level human rights delegation has just returned from Iraq. Human rights NGO, the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Our guests in the studio are Dr. Ronald Waldman, professor of clinical public health at the Malman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Elizabeth Benjamin, founder and supervising attorney of the New York Legal Aid Society's Health Law Unit, has been to Iraq four times. And Roger Norman, co-founder and executive director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Roger, let us begin with you. I actually wanted to follow up on Jeremy's report on this UN document that said strictly confidential about the significance of the preparations that are being made right now.
Well, I think this is one of the aspects that our research team looked at very carefully, and the findings of the research team, which can be described in more detail by my colleagues here, confirm what's said in those UN confidential documents. Essentially, they're expecting a major humanitarian crisis for which they are unprepared to deal with. Unprepared both in terms of the international agencies, but also the expected ability of the government of Iraq to cope with the crisis, with a particular issue being that our research team found that the only possible way to cope with this, or as effectively as possible, is through the existing networks that the government, the food distribution system, and the public health system, and there's great concern that these won't be utilized, but rather replaced, which would just exacerbate the crisis.
And your sense in terms of the infrastructure now, especially in areas like drinking water and electricity, there was a lot said in the mid 90s about the problems in Iraq, but then there has been sort of an indication that things have gotten better in the last few years as the UN has relaxed Iraq's ability to sell oil. Could you give us a summary of what things look like now?
Yes, let me quickly address that and then turn it to my colleagues. And that is, I think conditions, especially in the last few years under Oil for Food, have improved. But the overall conditions for the Iraqi people as compared to pre-1991 are still extremely bad. We term the population in a state of extreme vulnerability to any additional shocks of war. I think the important thing to keep in mind, Center for Economic and Social Rights was in Iraq 3 weeks after the first Gulf War and did a very thorough assessment. And it's not so much the bombing directly of sites like water and food. It's the bombing of the life support systems on which people depend for their health and their food, electricity being the key. If electricity is again targeted, you will see a massive problem in terms of a shutdown of the ability of people in an urban setting to get clean water and sanitation and a massive increase in disease.
Dr. Ronald Waldman, you have worked in emergencies in Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia, Albania, Congo, Afghanistan. You're the immediate past chair of the International Health Section of the American Public Health Association. What most struck you about this trip to Iraq and what the conditions are there?
One thing that's quite striking is the fact that Iraq is a country, unlike the others that you just mentioned, where I and many members of the humanitarian community have worked. It's a highly urbanized country with over 60%, maybe 70% of the population living in cities that have working and functioning systems, including mechanized water pumping stations. They get their water from taps, not usually from wells, with sophisticated plants for treating their sewage. These systems are highly vulnerable to attack, to military attack. They depend on electricity, and any targeting of the electrical systems is going to wreak havoc among that population. It's also striking in the sense that Iraq was a few years ago, quite a rapidly developing society. It ranked quite highly on the Human Development Index, and we've seen a population that has gone, particularly a health system, from one capable of providing highly sophisticated tertiary care to one which is currently struggling to hold on to some of the basic elements of a primary healthcare system.
And Elizabeth Benjamin, what about that healthcare system? You've been to Iraq numerous times. How have you noted the changes over the years and during this period of continued international sanctions?
When we first went in with the Center of Economic and Social Rights, we found that the healthcare system was completely degraded. Many of the hospitals have been, in fact, attacked during the different sort of uprisings and things like that. So from that baseline of things being really awful after the first Gulf War, I was struck by how things had progressed. And we now have a system where people are in hospitals. People, you know, we would go into people in a primary health care center would see 150, 175 patients a day. People were using the systems. They were working, albeit at a really sort of vulnerable level. For example, in the 12 hospitals we surveyed, 92% had shortages in equipment. 83% had problems with their drug supplies. That being said, what we don't recommend is the United Nations or the United States or whoever comes in, if there's a war, to come in and replace the system. It works. It's fragile, but it works. And that's our big take-home message.
Roger Norman, the issue of what will happen in Iraq, what the U.S. plans are when they talk about an invasion that would first involve in the first 24, 48 hours dropping more bombs than during the Persian Gulf War altogether. Where is the U.S. going to bomb? Who is there?
Well, on some of these questions, obviously, I'm speculating as anyone. We don't know what's information and what's disinformation coming out from our government and others. But I think the lesson from the 91 war is very important, and that is that no matter how serious the direct bombing assault is, it's always the longer-term impacts, the ripple effects from bombing infrastructure that's going to affect the population, especially the vulnerable population. I mean, this is why children, elderly, et cetera, had the worst impacts. But speaking about this specific war plan, informed speculation thinks that there will be a ground invasion north and south, and that the area around Baghdad, which will be the most heavily defended area by the Iraqi regime, will be choked off, essentially. And given the humanitarian findings that our team has and that the UN documents talk about, this is an extremely dangerous situation for that population. This would be a population, assuming, again, an attack on electricity, that will be without electricity, without clean water, drinking contaminated water, getting sick, without a public health system capable of coping with this, and in particular with absolutely no access to international aid, the international community, an isolated population.
Dr. Ronald Wallman.
Probably the most striking feature of the current situation is the enormous dependency of the population on the distribution of rations by the central government. It's estimated that about 60% of the population is totally dependent on a highly effective and efficient system of food distribution. This kind of dependency, which is quite vulnerable, of course, to attack, and represents a system that cannot easily be replaced and probably not in time to provide adequate support to the food needs of the population. This kind of a system made us compare in some ways the situation of the people of Iraq now to that of people living in some of the longer-term refugee camps that we find around the world.
In line with that, your report mentions that, quote, many U.S.-based NGOs have been participating in simulation exercises and coordination training activities with the Department of Defense. So in essence, that there are U.S.-based NGOs here already preparing hand-in-hand with the Defense Department to take over some of these functions. Does that raise questions about how they may be regarded by the general Iraqi population?
There's been increasing learning, attempts to learn. These are two very different cultures, the military culture and the humanitarian culture. And one would think that they should be kept separately, but the fact is that the military presence in humanitarian crises has been growing over the past decade. And there have been attempts by both sides to try to learn more about how each other works. We're quite concerned about the situation in Iraq or in a post-military intervention in Iraq, because many of these efforts perhaps have not been as successful as one might would have hoped. There seems to be a certain degree of secrecy, one could say, regarding the plans of the U.S. military for a post-intervention relief effort. There's been a great deal of speculation in the press, even documents have been leaked, regarding the possible military strategies that would be pursued, but there really hasn't been very much seen or heard about any plans that the military currently has regarding humanitarian intervention.
Let's cut to the chase here with NGOs. You're reporting that they're receiving something like $1 million from the U.S. government at this point, groups like CARE, Roger Norman?
Well, I think we need to put it into the larger context, and that is that since 91 and especially since Afghanistan, the U.S. military has been taking an increasingly direct role, people would say subordinating the humanitarian relief agencies in contradiction to the basic legal principles that govern humanitarian access, which is that populations have a right to receive aid and that agencies have a right to deliver it. That basic understanding that has been the essence of the Red Cross principles for decades is being completely challenged by the U.S. military's plans right now. What you have is, in the first case, Europe is not stepping forward with money for this because they don't feel it's their war, so that almost all the funding that's going to come is from the United States, from USAID. This means U.S. organizations, essentially, not European organizations, and we've heard many complaints from Oxfam, MSF, others about this situation, that they won't be given access. That's the first problem. Second problem is even those groups that are given funding are being picked and choosed among as to who will have access to the battlefield. This is very similar to the way the press has been treated in terms of pool reporting. And given the high political priority that President Bush is placing on this notion of we will feed and clothe and do whatever in the State of the Union address, we can anticipate a highly politicized and manipulated use of humanitarian, I'm expressing my opinion here, in what's going to happen. And it's very dangerous because the secrecy, as Professor Waldman talked about, is antithetical to the notion of an effective response that will save lives.
During the Gulf War, much was the big push to the American people in terms of propaganda, preparing them for war, was the Iraq's million-man army, that this enormous million-man army that the United States was going to confront. Now what you're hearing is the weapons of mass destruction and this enormous threat. When the reality what we're dealing with here is a small country with, as you mentioned, a degraded situation in terms of its basic infrastructure and living situation, what was your sense of the spirit of the Iraqi people as they're dealing with all of this, as they're confronting the possibility of this enormous attack? Elizabeth, what in your conversations with them, what sense did you get of their of how they look toward the future?
I was really struck by how people were carrying on. They were moving on with their lives. And on the surface, you know, they just said, we have to get up, we have to go to work. We go home and we watch TV, we get really depressed about what's happening and that our country may be bombed. But they were very functional. And in fact, I remember this one doctor in a primary healthcare center up in Mosul, and she was a really vivacious, strong lady. And I was like, oh, I wish she was my primary healthcare doctor back here in New York. And we were sort of talking, and it was a really nice conversation. And they were talking about their preparedness and all this other stuff. And it was really extraordinary until I said, so how do you explain all this to your kids? And her eyes welled up, and she choked up, and the whole room choked up. And there was like all these other male doctors in the room, and everybody just couldn't say anything until one of the other male doctors stepped forward and said, you know, we're used to this. They've been bombing us since the 80s. And because it was up in the north, he was talking about the Iran-Iraq War and then the Gulf War. And there was sort of this incredible pride and stoicism that I was overwhelmed by.
As we wrap up, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark is waiting in the wings. He wants to talk about the impeachment of George Bush. I just wanted to go back to this point of the UN NGOs. If the U.S. military is giving them $1 million and choosing which ones, like CARE, that it likes, so this will empower those, which will also, I would guess, mean that it will silence any criticism, and others that want to get the money will be marching to a similar drummer. What does it mean for the groups that are not going to get that money? How anyone who is a critic, Professor Waldman?
Well, I think there will be an outcry and a great deal of concern in the humanitarian community. The NGOs like to see themselves and, in fact, pride themselves on the principle of independence. These organizations are not supposed to act as instruments of government policy. They're supposed to formulate their own policies and strategies and provide assistance to those populations in need wherever they're found. That's the basic humanitarian principle that drives them. There's clearly a confrontation possible between the humanitarian culture and that of the military, and I think...
Unless they're paid off.
Oh, I just don't, I wouldn't want to speculate on that. There are several consortia. These are non-governmental organizations that should be remembered and not necessarily anti-governmental organizations. But they do receive, some of them, not all. Some are much more independent than others. Some of them receive a reasonably large proportion of their operational budgets from governmental sources. And I think it will provoke... some serious introspection and reflection amongst them, not only in the immediate future, but for many years to come.
Well, we want to thank you all very much for being with us. Last comment, 10 seconds, Roger Norman.
I was just going to say that there already is an outcry, especially from European groups who have some of the most experience in dealing with these kind of crises, and we can expect that to grow. And this is an issue where the public has a role. The public needs to say, why the secrecy on humanitarian issues when there's all the public talk about the war?
Roger Norman is head of the executive director of Center for Economic and Social Rights, based here in New York. Dr. Ronald Waldman, professor of clinical public health at the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. Elizabeth Benjamin, supervising attorney at the New York Legal Aid Society's Health Law Unit. They all have just returned from Iraq. When we come back, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, and then a report from the UN. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and among the groups that are getting the money from the U.S. government and military to coordinate humanitarian efforts, some might say to silence their criticism in Amman, Jordan, are the International Rescue Committee, World Vision, Save the Children, International Medical Corps, and Mercy Corps. Well, we are joined by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He says the Constitution provides a means to prevent George Bush from engaging in war. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's always a privilege to be here. The Constitution provides more than a means. It creates a duty. It says the President, the Vice President, and other high officials of the government of the United States on indictment and conviction shall be removed from office for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. The provisions for impeachment in the Constitution are by far the most comprehensive and specific in terms of removal of executive officers who are violating the law or their duties under the Constitution. It appears six places. And when you read the debates, you see without question that the greatest concern they had in creating a strong presidency, because moving from the Articles of Confederation, which had no executive government, it was a, what we would call a parliamentarian-type government, a legislative-type government, and dysfunctional because they couldn't agree on anything, you couldn't get action, they wanted to know that they could contain an arbitrary or tyrannical chief executive. They'd been through that with George III. They were familiar with 400 years of English history in which they talked of high crimes and misdemeanors. At that moment, they were desperately concerned with the struggle in India to impeach Warren Hastings, who was governor general there and who was accused of all kinds of high crimes and misdemeanors and general abuse of the people. So they were very serious about it. And our government has remained serious, and our people have remained serious about it after the Nixon or during the Nixon impeachment effort. We ought to remember that two of the last seven presidents, including the present, have had to address impeachment. President Nixon finally resigned, and most people believe it's when he saw that in the Senate he would lose in a trial on impeachment. And Bill Clinton 4 years ago was impeached, and one of the three articles by a vote of 229 to 205, and two other votes he was. But if you look back through the history that was compiled during the Nixon proceedings, C. Van Woodward put together with 14 prominent historians, most of them better known now than they were then, a 400-page volume that shows that in every presidency, impeachment has been a major issue. It's been raised when the people are not satisfied, or political parties, often it's a political matter, are not satisfied. Here we have unprecedented crimes of the most unimaginable sort, wars of aggression. We have a president talking about assassination and summary execution, a president who's so audacious that in his State of the Union message, he uttered words that people who care about this country should never forget. He said, all told, more than 3,000 suspected terrorists have been arrested in many countries, and many others have met a different fate. You ought to remember how he paused there and what he looked like. Let's put it this way. There's no longer a problem. It sounds like a B-grade organized crime movie where they're talking about people they've liquidated. He's talking about assassinations, summary executions there, and about to engage in just this incredible assault on a people who've already been assaulted beyond endurance for any moral qualities that remain on the planet. We have a website up. It's been up for about a week. It's www.votetoimpeach.org. It charges President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and the Attorney General John Ashcroft because of his failure to advise them that they're violating the law and his failure to protect civil rights and his personal direction to violate the Bill of Rights. And it's a means by which it's the constitutional means, and it's the nonviolent means that we have, other than direct persuasion, which we've been trying all along, to make the president obey the law and to proceed to impeachment. The grounds now, he threatened to use nuclear weapons, and he's already led us into one disaster after another. The people copying what he does caused the Iran, the Pakistani-India conflict, and things escalated desperately in the Palestine-Israeli conflict, and others are modeling on what he does, shoot first and ask questions later.
Well, there would definitely be quite a few people in the country who would think that consideration of impeachment in the case of President Bush should be higher on the agenda than it was, than the consideration of impeachment for President Clinton based on the alleged crimes that he committed. But the issue of how do you get the public attention or even the Congress when the Congress has in essence signed off on many of the activities that the president has been involved in?
Well, you have to show them what the people believe. I mean, I think Stokely Carmichael was wrong when he said power to the people. The power is in the people. The question is whether the people will exercise it. I think if the people stand up on impeachment, you'll find the Congress falling in line very quickly. Most of them, I mean, watching the State of the Union message, was the saddest part was to see how the Congress was reacting like robots in their applause for practically anything he might say, when the whole thing was an illusion on the domestic side and a threat of war of aggression on the international side. But I think if people have the will to address this issue themselves, if they care, and if they'll sign on to an impeachment resolution, impeachment is just a charge. No one's saying guilt or innocence. That's for the Senate to decide. And as a lawyer, I'd be the last one to prejudge that. But impeach, yes. The evidence for impeachment is overwhelming. And it comes it's confirmed by the president, by his own words.
When you say it's up to the people, what do you mean? I mean, you're trying to launch a whole movement here to impeach President George Bush. First, doesn't impeaching a president presuppose that president was democratically elected?
Not necessarily. You could impeach him for not being democratically elected, too. But if there were crimes or misdemeanors involved in the process.
And what do you see as the mechanism if people are interested in doing that?
The best mechanism is to let the members of Congress know that they want impeachment. I mean, all the people that are out demonstrating who believe that impeachment is a constitutional means should stand up now and vote for impeachment. A specific mechanism is this website that I've mentioned, this www.votetoimpeach.org. And if we get enough signatures on there, people are going to, in the Congress, are going to have to pay attention, and it'll go forward.
Ramsey Clark, let's go for a minute to the United Nations. Andreas Zumach is standing by. He's the Geneva-based UN correspondent with the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung. He's joining us from the UN. He is the reporter who in December obtained an unedited copy of Iraq's 12,000-page report to the United Nations, including portions of how Iraq acquired weapons from the United States, particularly U.S. corporations, German corporations. Names of corporations were redacted in the report that was later given out. Andreas Zumach, can you tell us where you are and what's happening right now at the U.N.?
What, sorry, say it again.
Can you tell us where you are and what's happening at the United Nations
right
now?
We only come in about 15 minutes, the first ministers, and there will be a brief meeting between the president, Mr. Fischer, who is the German foreign minister, who is doing the presiding over the meeting with Mr. Powell, and then probably toward 10:45 the meeting will start with up to 90-minute speech and presentation by Secretary of State Powell, followed by speeches, maximum 8 minutes, that's the plan, of all the other foreign ministers present, starting with China, ending with the German one, and then probably also the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations will have a chance to react to Secretary of State Powell's statement.
The fact that it is the German ambassador who is in charge here, can you talk about the significance of the German chairmanship of the UN Security Council?
Well, the significance is that so far, at least, given their public position, Germany is holding out as one of the strongest ones against a war against Iraq and ruling out any participation of Germany in such a war. Whether this position will still stand after today's meeting, one might have doubts, especially if France should begin to waver, for which there are some indications. Then Germany will make sure that they will not be isolated at the end. But so far, Germany's position is that the inspection should be given all the time that's necessary, that so far the status quo is we do have inspections based on Resolution 1441. Nobody yet, according to the German ambassador, Mr. Pleuger, has requested to change the status quo, meaning to put any kind of limit or deadline or end on the inspection. And he says whoever wants this has to come forward and probably present some text for a resolution to the Council that then would contain some kind of deadline or end. But so far, again, as of yesterday, nobody has tried that. That's at least the official announcement by the Germans.
And we have here in the studio former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Can you tell us Secretary Powell's speech today in terms of how you see its importance in the move toward war and whether you think you'll be able to make any kind of a different case than has been made so far by the Bush administration?
I don't see him as making any case other than argument, but firmly showing the obsession with the United States government again to commit war. We ought to remember his words when he was asked at the end of the bombing in 1991 how many Iraqi people had been killed. He said, frankly, that's not a question that interests me very much. And I presume that he's still of that view, which is murderous.
Former Attorney General Ramsey Clark in the studio, Andrei Zumach at the United Nations right now. Andrei Zumach, the word is that General Powell will be playing some tapes. Also, he'll be talking about documents that he will not allow ambassadors to take away with them. What is the significance of this?
Well, this is at least what has been announced by members of the U.S. delegation to the U.N. last week. Staffers of Ambassador John Negroponte said lots of the material, or most of the material, will only be shown and then will be collected at the end of the meeting, and the other 11 foreign ministers and two ambassadors who will be present are not allowed to take it home to have it checked by their own experts, their own intelligence services in their respective capitals. If this should really be what's going to happen today, I think the question marks behind how much proof there is actually for what the Bush administration is claiming will be even bigger than they are already. I find it astonishing that the German presidency seems not to be prepared for such a situation. Ambassador Bleuger, in his press conference, his public on-the-record press conference yesterday with UN correspondents, was asked the question whether he received assurances by the Bush administration that all the material and the proof and the evidence that's being put on the table today could be taken home by the other 14 members of the Security Council in order to allow a fair assessment, because, after all, this is supposed to be the basis for future decisions. And his answers, Mr. Bleuger's answers, was no, he did not receive any assurances, and he didn't seek for those, and he found the question rather ridiculous. This indicates that, obviously, Germany, officially presiding over today's meeting, is not really in control, which also became clear last week when the Bush administration announced today's meeting, not even consulting Germany beforehand, and effectively preventing a meeting which was set for today, this morning in Berlin, the capital of Germany, between the German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer and the UN Chief Inspector Hans Blakes and the Director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, who both now will be here today sitting on the side of the meeting.
And Ramsey Clark, the irony of John Negroponte being our UN ambassador and being the one who's basically been carrying the torch here at the UN, pressing for war.
As all the misery of Central America and other parts come back to mind, to me the most important thing for the United Nations to recognize is at this moment it's at risk as an institution. If it can't now assert its independence and stand up and do its duty under the charter, then its utility is questionable. The United States has dominated it too long, and the risk is too great. And if this war goes forward after all this deliberation, not on the basis of evidence and investigation of people who've been on the ground in there for most of the last 12 years, the investigators, but on the basis of what some Secretary of State comes in with paper he won't show you and says,
well, certainly,
heaven help us.
Well, certainly it very strongly looks like that right now. I wouldn't dispute that. But I would still argue that it's not only members of the Security Council here in New York who ask to see convincing or compelling proof, but it's also, I think, still the majority of the American people who expect that from the Bush administration. And it's certainly the majority of the world public opinion outside the United States and many, many governments, by certainly the vast majority of the 191 member countries of the United Nations, expect at least this kind of compelling proof as a minimum basis for then consulting about whether or not military action or not might be the appropriate action. Because even if there should be, just right now while we are talking, Secretary of State Powell is coming in front of the UN and driving into, I see him outside
and
my window.
Yeah. On that moment and that note, we will have to end the program. Thank you very much, Andrei Zumach, and in our studio, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. His website is
Vote to impeach.org.
And that does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Tia Lesson, and a happy birthday to Fatima Mojadidi. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get video at 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I believe that Iraq is now in further material breach of its obligations. I believe this conclusion is irrefutable and undeniable.
Colin Powell uses photographs, tape conversations, and information, he says, from Iraqi defectors and others to argue why the U.S. should be able to attack Iraq first. But Europe and the anti-war movement don't buy it.
General Powell did not convince the international audience who want the inspectors to continue. There were no smoking guns, but a lot of smoke and mirrors.
And as people mobilize around the country and the world against war, New York police try to stop a major February 15th march.
And yesterday, United for Peace and Justice brought the city of New York into federal court, demanding that they give us the right to march on February 15th.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State General Colin Powell spoke before the United Nations Security Council yesterday. He put forward an array of evidence to make his case for a first strike attack on Iraq. His presentation included satellite photographs, tapes, the U.S. said, of intercepted conversations between Iraqi military officers, and information from Iraqi defectors and people seized in Afghanistan and elsewhere since September 11th. Powell's 70-plus minute presentation can be boiled down to a few main points. He said Iraq possesses extremely dangerous weapons of mass destruction. It's systematically trying to deceive UN inspectors and hide prohibited weapons, and that Iraq is harboring terrorists, including al-Qaeda. But much of the evidence Powell presented is impossible to verify. Powell's speech was peppered with assertions like "our sources tell us" or "we know that." Defectors and detainees were not named. An article on the front page of the New York Times reads, "Powell's trademark, overwhelm them," referring to the infamous Powell doctrine of using overwhelming force. Britain's Financial Times dubbed Powell's presentation on Iraq an effective performance. France and Russia said the evidence only strengthened the case for further inspections and proposed doubling or tripling the UN presence in Iraq. Iraq rejected the presentation as a fraud. But Britain pronounced Iraq in grave new breach of Security Council resolutions. Spain's prime minister urged the Spanish parliament to back Spain's uncompromising support of the United States even before Powell spoke. Members of the United Left Party in Spain stood with posters reading, "War, no." 10 Eastern European countries put out a statement backing the U.S. They're all aspiring to NATO membership. Meanwhile, the prime minister of Turkey said he'll ask parliament to open the country's bases to thousands of U.S. troops. North Korea is warning that it will preemptively attack U.S. troops if the Bush administration increases its military presence in the Pacific region. North Korea also warned any U.S. strike against its nuclear facilities at Yongbyon would trigger a full-scale war. The threats come a day after North Korea announced it has reactivated its nuclear power plant. North Korea says the reactor will be used for peaceful purposes, including electricity production, but the U.S. and nuclear analysts say the reactor could help mass-produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. The site had been mothballed since 1994 as part of a non-proliferation deal with Washington. The preemptive warning comes after the U.S. threatened to send more aircraft carriers, bombers, and troops to the Pacific Ocean as a deterrent against North Korea. More than 100 Irish soldiers are now stationed at Shannon Airport to ward off anti-war protests. In the past 2 weeks, peace activists have twice attacked U.S. Navy planes with hammers and hatchets in an effort to disarm them. The U.S. military is using the airport as a stopover for flights headed to the Middle East. Also, in response to the protests, one private airline, World Airways, which is working with the military, has diverted at least 17 of its flights from Ireland to Germany. The International Court of Justice has ruled the United States should halt the planned executions of three Mexicans who were denied legal help from the Mexican government. U.S. lawyers dismissed the case as a publicity stunt, saying the court's order to stay the executions infringes on its sovereignty over its criminal justice system. The U.S. economy is suffering its most severe hiring slump in 20 years. This, according to the New York Times, this has caused about 1 million people to drop out of the labor force since last summer. That is, those neither working nor looking for a job. 2 million jobs have been lost since March 2001, when the recent recession began. The Los Angeles Times reports only 45% of Americans favor Bush's reelection in 2004. The Maine Senate has endorsed a resolution asking President Bush to pursue a diplomatic solution with Iraq rather than going to war. The 18-15 Maine Senate vote represents the first time a state legislative body has taken a stance against war in Iraq. 63 U.S. cities have voted to support similar resolutions. A new study out of Sweden shows using a cellular phone could cause nerve damage in the brain. Unlike most previous cell phone studies, the Swedish scientists from Lund University examine nerve damage, not the growth of cancer. Overnight, four Palestinians and two Israelis were killed in separate incidents in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. This comes a day after Israeli forces crushed to death a 65-year-old woman when they bulldozed her home in the Maghazi refugee camp. The woman's family said she didn't hear the warnings. Israeli troops barred a relative from returning to save her. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez announced new economic measures, including currency trading and price controls, to shore up the economy, reeling from a 63-day national management lockout. The opposition on Sunday ended the general strike but kept the strike in force against the state oil company, vowing to continue its struggle to remove the populist president from office. In South Africa, witnesses say two white police officers deliberately ordered their dogs as part of a training exercise to attack three black immigrants from Mozambique in 1998. The incident was caught on videotape and broadcast on national television. And the Hip Hop Summit Action Network is calling for a boycott of Pepsi products. The group charges Pepsi displayed a double standard by running ads featuring the foul-mouthed rock legend Ozzy Osbourne and his family after it quashed an ad featuring rapper Ludacris because of complaints that the musician's lyrics were profane and sexually explicit. And almost 400 genetically modified pigs have accidentally been sold as food in the United States. This, according to the Food and Drug Administration. And United for Peace and Justice yesterday filed a lawsuit in New York over its refusal, the New York City Police Department's refusal to issue a march permit for an anti-war rally on February 15th. We'll have more on that story later in the program.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned.
War. Bob Marley. He would have been 58 years old today. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State General Colin Powell spoke before the United Nations Security Council. He presented an array of evidence to make his case for a first strike attack on Iraq, including satellite photographs, tapes of intercepted conversations between Iraqi military officers, and information, he said, from Iraqi defectors and people seized in Afghanistan and elsewhere since September 11th. Powell's speech lasted more than 70 minutes. He said Iraq possesses extremely dangerous weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is systematically trying to deceive UN inspectors and hide prohibited weapons, and that Iraq is harboring terrorists, including al-Qaeda. But much of the evidence Powell presented is impossible to verify. Powell's speech was peppered with assertions like "our sources tell us," or "we know that," "defectors and detainees were not named." Powell also resorted to drama at times. At one point, he held up a vial filled with white powder. France and Russia said the evidence only strengthened the case for further inspections and proposed doubling or tripling the UN presence in the country. Iraq rejected the presentation as a fraud. But Britain pronounced Iraq in grave new breach of Security Council resolutions. Spain's prime minister urged the Spanish parliament to back Spain's uncompromising support, the U.S., even before the Powell spoke. Members of the United Left Party in Spain stood with posters reading, "War, no." Well, today we're going to take an in-depth look at Powell's speech. We'll hear some excerpts from Colin Powell. We'll hear the response the special advisor to Saddam Hussein gave last night in Baghdad. We'll be joined in our studio by United Nations expert Phyllis Bennis, as well as James Paul. And we're going to talk about the protests that are being organized around the country. But we thought we'd first start with evidence that Colin Powell presented. He called it evidence. Audio clips he played just minutes into his presentation. Powell says the clips are communications between Iraqi military officers that were intercepted by the U.S. government. In the first conversation, two officers speak on the day before UN weapons inspectors resumed, Powell said. One says they still have a modified vehicle. The other appears surprised and says, quote, "I'm worried you all have something left." The other replies, "We evacuated everything. We don't have anything left." In a minute, we're going to go to Baghdad to Jeremy Scahill, who have a response from the Iraqi government. But to give us a taste of the conversations, we'll play a few seconds from the second audio piece Powell played. Then Powell explains it.
هذا بعد ما نفذتوا مضمونه اتلفوا الكتاب
لا
يعني ما اريد احد يشوف هذا الكتاب
ماشي
اي والله
ماشي
ممنون
Let me pause again and review the elements of this message. They are inspecting the ammunition you have, yes, yes, for the possibility there are forbidden ammo. For the possibility there is by chance forbidden ammo, yes. And we sent you a message yesterday to clean out all of the areas, the scrap areas, the abandoned areas, make sure there is nothing there. Remember the first message, evacuate it. This is all part of a system of hiding things and moving things out of the way and making sure they have left nothing behind. You go a little further into this message and you see the specific instructions from headquarters. After you have carried out what is contained in this message, destroy the message because I don't want anyone to see this message. Okay, okay. Why? Why? This message would have verified to the inspectors that they have been trying to turn over things. They were looking for things, but they don't want that message seen because they were trying to clean up the area to leave no evidence behind of the presence of weapons of mass destruction. And they can claim that nothing was there and the inspectors can look all they want and they will find nothing. This effort to hide things from the inspectors is not one or two isolated events. Quite the contrary. This is part and parcel of a policy of evasion and deception that goes back 12 years, a policy set at the highest levels of the Iraqi regime.
Secretary of State General Colin Powell speaking before the United Nations Security Council yesterday. We go now to Baghdad to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill. Welcome, Jeremy. You went to a news conference yesterday of the Iraqi government responding to Powell's address.
That's right. And when General Colin...
Jeremy, we'll have to come back to you. We're having trouble hearing you. Go ahead. We'll try it once more. We'll have to give you a call back. You are listening to Democracy Now! We are also joined by guests in our studio. We're joined by Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she is author of the book Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. We are also joined by James Paul, Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum, as well Assad Abu Khalil, who is author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism, and the forthcoming book, The House of Bush and House of Saud. We'll be playing excerpts of Powell's speech and getting response. Phyllis, let's begin with you.
I think, Amy, that what
General Powell faces was two major problems. On the one hand, and the main reason that I think the speech did not convince anyone in the international audience who was not already siding with the U.S., whether out of belief or more often out of pressure, such as the NATO wannabes who are so eager to remain in the good graces of Washington, the main problem he faced is that the evidence, so-called, cannot be verified. It was based on claims of what, for example, a photograph of a big truck with things on it, what really was. He says it's a mobile biological laboratory, something that Hans Blix has said they never found evidence even existed. And we look at the picture, and what we see is it's a big truck. They tell us in a drawing what the trucks may look like inside if it were a mobile biological laboratory, but there's certainly no way to verify that. The second problem that General Powell faces is what we might call the what-if test, the even-if test. Even if everything he said was true, does it present a legitimate cause for war? And that, in my view, clearly failed. It failed to win over international opinion. It failed to win a significant number of waverers in the U.S., although, of course, there was a small spike in public shifting towards General Powell, not a spike that I think will last. But it doesn't pass the even-if test. It doesn't acknowledge that even if everything was true, is the war the way to deal with this? Is it worth the lives of 100,000 Iraqis and potentially tens or hundreds or thousands of U.S. and other troops in a massive war? The answer to that is simply not. He did not make the case.
Assad Abukali, your response.
I think that based on all the propaganda hype that preceded the speech, I personally was expecting a picture of bin Laden sitting in Saddam Hussein's lap, and I think that the result was extremely less than what one expects. Really, this is an anthology of generalizations, inaccuracies, and redundancies. And I think that, first of all, it's important to note that the American public, I think that's where the speech is going to be effective, is much more trusting of its government than any of the people of other democracies. And that's not going to play well outside of the United States, I think. On the areas of the weapons of mass destruction, there is really nothing new there. And this information was the same at the disposal of Colin Powell, who conveniently 2 or 3 months ago was himself an advocate of sanctions. So here we see a political change, not based on any change of facts. On the last section of the speech, and I must confess that the evidence is even weaker than the first two parts of the speech, and I say that I listened to the original Arabic recordings, and I say that what was played to us, the intercept, the phone intercept, first of all, I mean, we can very much be very suspicious about anything coming out of either Iraq or the United States at this highly propaganda times, because the United States itself in the first Gulf War resorted to a lot of inaccuracies and propaganda fabrications to justify its action, and I think we're seeing something like that. Why, I mean, as Phyllis said, why should we have, you know, blind faith in what the U.S. is producing and telling us we should believe these satellite photos, knowing that they fabricated satellite photos to convince Saudi Arabia back in 1990 to invite American troops into the country? And the phone intercepts, I personally am not impressed with the Arabic translation. I'm not saying these are not accurate recording. They could be, very well be, but the translation are not really that good. For example, when the two people are referring to the committee coming, there's no reference to the committee in the Arabic original. They talk about the folks are coming, and then they made it into a committee in the English translation they provided to us. There's a couple of few other ones, like when they talk about a modified vehicle. The original Arabic is far more ambiguous and general and could mean a lot of things. I am not saying that it is not true what the American government is saying, but I am saying it requires much more hard evidence than we are seeing. The last point is, the weakest part is the references to Al-Qaeda and Iraq link. They have been working so hard on fabricating information on that, and they invented the story of Muhammad Atta, the lead hijacker, meeting with an Iraqi intelligence officer. And only when the Czech Republic basically officially and publicly protested, they stopped peddling that story. What they basically produced about Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, it's important to note that, first of all, he is linked not to Al-Qaeda, in fact, but to a group called Ansar al-Islam, which is headquartered not in Iraq that is under the control of the Saddam Hussein's government, but in fact in the areas under Kurdish and U.S. control in the very north. And just today in the Arabic newspapers, many of them are saying basically much of that story came from Jordanian intelligence services, who have a long history of torture, falsehood, and lies.
We're going to break. When we come back, we will play what General Colin Powell had to say about al-Qaeda. We are talking to Asad Abu Khalil. He is author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism. Phyllis Bennis in the studio with us. We'll also speak with James Paul, executive director of the